Small Wonder event. Annalena McAvee in the middle, Tom Rachman closest to me, and our chair for this session, William Skidelsky. So the newspaper world is replete with stories, and the characters who inhabit that world are sometimes as colourful as the subjects who feature in the pages. Each paper has its own culture and is to some extent a closed society. Recently, newspapers themselves have become the story. So no wonder that the press is ripe for fiction. And both Annalena McAvee and Tom Rachman draw on their own experiences in their recent books. Annalena worked in newspapers for more than three decades before her debut novel this year, The Spoiler. She was arts and literary editor for the Financial Times and founded the Guardian Review, which she edited for 6 years. The Spoiler revolves around two female journalists, as you will hear, one a veteran war correspondent and the other a writer of celebrity gossip. Can they possibly have anything in common in the modern age? Tom Rachman's Link story collection, The Imperfectionist, traces the fortunes of an international newspaper and its employees from its foundation in Rome in the 1950s to the digital era. Tom himself has been a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press, stationed in Rome, with assignments taking him all over the world. He also worked as an editor at the International Herald Tribune in Paris. William Skidelsky, currently the literary editor of The Observer, will bring another insider's perspective to his role as chair. Now, the structure of this evening is that Tom will read and talk about his book, The Imperfectionist, first, followed by Annalena talking about The Spoiler, and then Will will conduct a conversation between them, and then they'll welcome questions from the audience. So I'm delighted to welcome all our speakers again and to hand over to Tom Rachman.
Thank you. Hello. So I will begin just by giving a quick idea of the way that this novel is structured, which is relevant to what follows. It's, as she said, it's a series of stories that all together, I hope, constitute a novel. And each of these chapters tells the tale of a different character at this international newspaper in Rome. So the world of journalism and the world of reporting abroad was something that I knew quite well personally. I had reported in various cities overseas. I had been a reporter and an editor in New York and in Rome and Paris, and I'd worked in Turkey and Cairo and Japan and South Korea and various other places. But I have to interrupt that sort of list of datelines there to say that one of the first things that all foreign correspondents will do as soon as they find a captive audience is immediately start reeling off their list of exotic foreign locales. It's part of the sort of the boast of the foreign correspondent. And I have to then make clear that I was by no means a swashbuckling reporter. I think I would have liked to have been one, but I failed at every opportunity. I think that a sort of emblematic story of my life in journalism was, it was, I think, 2003, and it was after the invasion of Iraq, and there was a great deal of copy that was coming into Cairo, which was the sort of hub for the Middle East region at that point, and I was sent there to help out with editing and sitting on a desk and just, you know, rewriting copy and so forth. So I thought, I'm in the Middle East, I'm in this extraordinary region, and this is an opportunity, finally, to do something bold, to do something grand, and to turn myself into the sort of heroic foreign reporter that I had always dreamed of being. So I came up with this idea that I would do a story in which I would get an Arabian stallion and I would ride through the desert and have the pyramids on the horizon. And actually, I didn't really have it planned very much beyond that. But something was going to happen. It was going to be quite dramatic. And at the end of it, I would be a proper foreign correspondent. So I went there and I did this story, except that it didn't turn out precisely as I had hoped. The sort of pristine Egyptian sands that I had imagined were sort of littered with Coke bottles and bags of crisps and the like. And the Arabian stallion that I had rented actually was not really a stallion at all, and more sort of quite a bad-tempered mare that kept trying to bite me through much of the ride. The pyramids were there, so that was a relief. Unfortunately, there was also a Kentucky Fried Chicken in the other direction, which sort of undermined the visuals. I also hadn't taken into account that if you're to gallop through the deep desert, you do have to know how to ride a horse. And that was a bit of a problem for me. So it was not a great deal of galloping, but a lot of sort of clinging. And that was more or less, the typical story of me trying to be the bold foreign correspondent. So when I sat down to write a novel, and really that was what I had always wanted to do, and it was the reason I had entered journalism in the first place, was to sort of gather material and experiences. When I sat down to finally do it, it was naturally these sorts of bumbling characters whose experiences and lives and attitudes towards it all I could relate to quite personally that attracted me, and hence the title, The Imperfectionists. So I thought I would read to you from a chapter about one of the many slightly fumbling, failed characters in this book. It's the second one, and each of the chapters in this book has a title which is a sort of fake headline that somehow appears within that chapter. So this one is called "World's Oldest Liar Dies at 126," and it's about the obituary writer Arthur Gopal. Arthur's cubicle used to be near the water cooler, but the boss is tired of having to chat with him each time they got thirsty. So the water cooler stayed, and he was moved. Now his desk is in a distant corner, as far from the locus of power as possible, but nearer the cupboard of pens, which is a consolation. He arrives at work, flops into his rolling chair, and remains still. This persists until inertia and continued employment cease to be mutually tenable, at which point he wriggles off his overcoat, flicks on the computer, and checks the latest news reports. Well, no one has died, or rather 107 people have in the previous minute, 154,000 in the past day, and 1,078,000 in the past week. But no one who matters. That's good. It's been 9 days since his last obit, and he hopes to extend the streak. His overarching goal at the paper is indolence, to publish as infrequently as possible, and to sneak away when no one is looking. He is realizing these professional ambitions spectacularly. He opens a manila folder so that if anyone happens past, he can flutter sheets, peer up irascibly, and mutter, "Preparedness," which seems to put most people off. Not all people, sadly. Clint Oakley appears behind him, and Arthur swivels around in his chair as if twisted by a garrote. "Clint, hi, morning. Yeah, no, I've been over the wires. There was nothing obvious. I mean, not to me, at least. Not so far." He despises this tendency to justify himself so abjectly to his superiors. He should shut up. "Didn't you see it?" "See what?" "Are you serious?" Clint is a specialist in queries that are at once hectoring and incomprehensible. "Don't you read email? Wake up, faggot." He raps Arthur's monitor as if it were a skull. "Anybody home?" Clint Oakley, Arthur's boss, is a dandruff-reigning, baseball-obsessed, sexually resentful Alabamian with a toilet brush mustache and an inability to maintain eye contact. He's also the culture editor, an ironic posting if considered. "Rectum," he says, apparently meaning Arthur, and struts back to his office. "If history has taught us anything," Arthur muses, "it is that men with mustaches must never achieve positions of power." Sadly, the paper has not heeded this truism because Clint has authority over all special sections, including obituaries. Lately, he has heaped endless chores upon Arthur, ordering him to collate This Day in History, Brain Teasers, Puzzle Wuzzle, The Daily Ha Ha, and World Weather, in addition to his regular necrological duties. Arthur finds the email Clint was referring to. It's from the editor-in-chief, Kathleen Solson, who wants preparedness, that is, an obituary prepared before the subject dies, on Gerda Erzberger. Who on earth is that? He checks the internet. She turns out to be an Austrian intellectual, once lauded by feminists, then decried by them, and then forgotten. And why should the paper care that she's about to die? Well, because Kathleen happens to have read Erzberger's memoirs while at college, and, as Arthur knows, news is often a polite way of saying editor's whim. Kathleen arrives to discuss the piece. I'm working on it right now, he says preemptively. On Goethe? Goethe, do you know her personally? If the answer is yes, his assignment assumes fresh peril. Not well, you know, I met her a couple of times at events. So she's not a friend, then, he suggests, hopefully. And how urgent would you say this is? Which is to say, when's she planning to die? Unclear, Kathleen responds. She's not having treatment. And is that good or bad? Well, it's typically not that good with cancer. Listen, I'd like us to do this properly for once, give you enough time to get an interview with her, go up there and so on, not just working from clips. Go up where? She lives outside Geneva. You can have the secretaries work out travel arrangements. Travel. Travel means effort and a night away from home. Bleak. And nothing is worse than obit interviews. He must never disclose to his subjects what he's researching, because they tend to become distressed. So he claims to be working on a profile. He draws out the moribund interviewee, confirms the facts he needs, then sits there, pretending to jot notes, stewing in guilt, remarking, "Extraordinary, and did you really?" All the while, he knows how little will make it into print. Decades of a person's life condensed into a few paragraphs, with a final resting place at the bottom of page 9, between Puzzle Wuzzle and World Weather. At this disheartening thought, he sneaks out of the office to fetch his daughter. Pickle, who is 8, emerges from the school, satchel strap around her throat, arms flat at her sides, pot belly distended, glasses scanning nothing in particular, her untied shoelaces flailing with each step. "Antiques?" he asks, and she slips her hand into his, squeezing it in affirmation. To Via dei Coronari they amble hand in hand. He observes her from above, her tangled black hair and tiny ears and the thick lenses that bend and swell the cobblestones. She babbles softly and snorts with amusement. She's a wonderful nerd, and he hopes this won't change. He'd be distressed if she were cool. It'd be as if his flesh and blood had grown up to be purple. "Your aspect," he says, "recalls that of a chimpanzee." She is humming softly and offers no response. After a minute, she says, "And you remind me of an orangutan." "I can't argue with that." "No, I cannot argue with that. Oh, by the way," he adds, "I have another one for you. Tina Pachutnik." "Say it again?" "Pachutnik, Tina." She shakes her head. "Impossible to say." "Do you like the Tina, at least?" "I'm willing to consider it." She has been looking for a pseudonym. Not for any purpose, but because it took her fancy. "What about Zeus?" she asks. "Oh, it's taken, I'm afraid, although he has been gone long enough that there'd be little room for confusion. And would you be using it like that? Would it be Zeus on its own, or would it be Zeus something?" She opens her pudgy hand within his cool, dry palm, and he releases her. She drifts, stepping over her own feet, beside him but abstracted, apart. When she swoops back, plunges her fingers into his, and looks up, her nostrils swelling with mischief. "What?" he asks. "Frog," she says. "I forbid it," he replies. "Frog is a boy's name." She shrugs an oddly adult gesture in such a little girl. They enter one of the opulent antique shops on Via dei Coronari. The clerks watch Arthur and Pickle closely. The two of them come here often, never buying, except once when she knocked over a mantel clock and Arthur had to pay for it. She prods a 1920s telephone. "Oh yeah, you hold that part to your ear," Arthur explains, "and you talk into the other bit." But how do you make a call?" He sticks his fingers into the dial and cranks a rotation. "You've never seen a phone like this before? My God, when I was growing up, this is all we had. Imagine the strife. Hard times, my dear, hard times." Back home, Arthur prepares her a Nutella sandwich. She eats one every afternoon, legs dangling from the kitchen chair, smudges of chocolate accruing on the underside of her nose. He tears off the crust and pops it into his mouth. "Father tax," he explains, chewing. She does not object. When Visantha's car pulls up outside, Pickle hurriedly swallows her last bite, and Arthur hastens to rinse off the sticky plate. It's as if a teacher approached. How is work?" he asks his wife. "Okay, and what are you guys up to?" "Nothing much." Pickle ambles off to the television room and Arthur absent-mindedly follows. They chat in there and laugh at their TV show. Visantha trails in. What are you guys watching? Oh, just some junk, he replies. Pickle hands him the remote and wanders off to her room. He watches her go down the hall, then turns to Visantha. You know what she told me today? She doesn't remember the 20th century. Isn't that terrifying? Not particularly. What are we doing for dinner? Pickle, he calls down the hall. Any thoughts on dinner? The secretaries book Arthur from Rome to Geneva by rail, a 10-hour journey with connections in Milan and Brig. Supposedly, this saves money on a short-notice flight, but is a colossal nuisance for him. He boards the early train at Stazione Termini, buys pastries in the cafeteria carriage, and, squashed amid the second-class rabble, settles into the first volume of Erzberger's memoirs, which is called, modestly, In the Beginning. From the author photo, Erzberger is, or was, in her early 30s, pretty and gaunt, with shoulder-length dark hair and twisted ironic lips. The picture is from 1965, when the book came out. She must be in her 70s by now. As his train pulls into Geneva in the early evening, he lifts his nose from the book and stares at the seat back before him. From the blurbs on the internet, he had expected a weary, politically dated autobiography, but instead her prose communicates courage and humanity. He studies her photo again and feels scandalously unprepared. He passes customs, obtains Swiss francs, and finds a cabbie who will take him to her house, which is just across the French border. The taxi drops him on a wet country road. The red taillights disappear down the hill. He is sweaty, uncertain, late. He dislikes being late, yet invariably is. Rubs his hands together, huffs a breath cloud onto them. Yes, this is the place, that's the right number, and the pines, like she said. After a little searching, he finds a gate within the pleached fence and enters. Her home is built of sturdy timber beams with icicles hanging from the eaves like wizards' caps. He snaps one off, he can never resist, and turns around to survey the twilight sky. A crust of clouds overlays the Alps. The icicle drips down his wrist. She opens the door behind him. Hi, sorry I'm late, he says, then switches to German. Sorry, I was just admiring the view. Come in, she says. You can leave the icicle outside, please. Thank you.
Thank you, sorry.
Well, my novel is set in 1997, which was in British newspapers and American newspapers, I think, pretty much a cusp time, when it was still possible for very distinguished commentators to think that the internet was but a passing fad and would have no impact on our lives or advertising or indeed jobs in journalism. And I pit two journalists against each other, as Diana said, one a distinguished elderly foreign correspondent and the other a very ambitious young woman who is at the moment working on the celebrity section of a broadsheet newspaper. Remember broadsheets? And this was at a time of, as it's always been, falling circulations, when the broadsheets were beginning to think that maybe they should be addressing celebrity culture and dumbing down in an effort to win new readers. So this is my description of the newspaper where my trashy character, no, she's not, Tamara works. Okay. The Monitor was a broad church broadsheet, a daily and Sunday operation, embracing a tabloid robustness in its gossip and celebrity coverage, and a rigorously cerebral approach in its opinion pages and its Sunday colour magazine. While other newspapers, as the new millennium approached, might cling to old-fashioned monocultural notions of their readership, the pioneering Monitor swung both ways. It was founded in the 19th century by an aristocratic Whig, who hoped the enterprise would make him a rapid fortune. He went bankrupt within a decade, and the newspaper, in keeping with its tradition, had been losing money ever since. In the early years of the 20th century, in the hands of a social-climbing northern industrialist, it had restyled itself as a paper of record, hoping to woo the establishment readers of the Times and the Courier. But in its most recent incarnation, under a new proprietor from the former Soviet Union, the Monitor had energetically set about broadening its appeal in an effort to boost dwindling circulation. Politically, too, though its current editor's personal inclination was rightwards, the paper hedged its bets, judging that if the tired Tory government was defeated by fresh-faced New Labour, or vice versa, in the coming elections, the Monitor should not be too closely identified with the losing side. In this spirit, it attacked MPs on both sides of the House with a high-minded, even-handedness. Its aim was to be all things to all men and women, and, like a 20th century Tower of Babel, the paper accommodated many competing voices in its five-story ramshackle block of dun concrete. The precise structure of the Monitor's intellectual hierarchy was reflected in the layout of its office, a poorly converted former print works a mile up the road from its old Fleet Street base, now the opulent marble-pillared headquarters of a firm of libel lawyers. The Monitor's basement bunker, which accommodated Pst, the celebrity magazine, listings magazine, edited by affable old Etonian waster Simon Pettigrew, was a windowless corridor comprising the largest portion, the long vertical stroke of an L-shaped arrangement of desks which had been carved out of a segment of the canteen and was separated on the left side by a partition wall from a suite of chronically malfunctioning lavatories. Pust's neighbouring office, the short horizontal stroke of the L, was occupied by the paper's website, a fledgling experimental operation run on a 24-hour basis by tireless teenagers, their faces studded with piercings, and edited by Tanya Singh, an Oxford graduate with tiny fairy features and the incandescent ambition of a young Bonaparte. Above them, on the ground floor, with windows opening onto the thrum of gridlocked traffic shimmering in a haze of fumes, were the ashen-faced toilers of the Monitor's newsroom. Here, against the background blare and flicker of half a dozen TV sets, the home desk rewrote the wire stories and worked the phones and fax machines, searching for news of political scandals, serial killers, and freak weather incidents in London and the remote regions of the UK. Around the corner on the ground floor, separated from news by the reception desk, where importuning members of the public were kept at bay by bouncers in business suits, was the mailroom. Here, ex-printers, redeployed as messengers by the advent of new technology, shared cigarettes, tea, and sporting gossip between genial forays into the building's further reaches with sacks of post. On the same floor was advertising, whose staff were distinguished from their newsroom colleagues by the fastidiousness of their dress and the bright-eyed, undifferentiated enthusiasm usually associated with revivalist sects of the American South. Above them, on the first floor, were sport and human resources. Here, too, was located Miles Denby, the managing editor, a haunted figure rarely seen outside his office, a glass box like a see-through confessional, marooned in the centre of the open-plan sports department. He was responsible for expenses, budgets, administration and staffing matters. He was currently meant to be addressing demands for a multi-faith prayer room, which the new politics editor, a recent convert to Catholicism, insisted should replace the third floor smoking room. Instead, Denby was reputed to sit all day in his cubicle, his telephone switched off, translating the plays of Aristophanes into unperformable contemporary dramas. In conversation, he was a man of few words. most of them synonyms for sorry. He was said to have had a catheter fitted to avoid inconvenient encounters in the men's room with expenses claimants, smokers, and recent converts to Catholicism. The second floor accommodated the features desk, run by the quixotic Johnny Malkinson. The prevailing atmosphere here was a grudging hush, as in a sixth form crammer the week before exams. But the team's youth and native high spirits would occasionally find madcap release in the pursuit of work. Then unwary visitors to this floor could be forgiven for thinking they had wandered into the company creche, or an outreach course for teenage sufferers of attention deficit disorder. Visitors might have to negotiate nodding thickets of red balloons, say, or shout to make themselves heard over a fusillade of Mardi Gras whistles on the day Monitor Extra was producing a special issue on power-broking party organizers. Occasionally, a representative from Human Resources would be sent upstairs to ask features to keep the noise down. A more persistently serene atmosphere prevailed on the third floor, with its view of the topmost branches of a row of blighted sycamores. Here, the scholarly denizens of the arts and books pages coexisted peacefully, if uncomprehendingly, with the bizarrely costumed members of the fashion department. This floor was the main staging post for the messengers who, when not sharing cigarettes, tea, and sporting gossip, spent most of their day in convoy from the ground floor mailroom like an endless column of ants, bringing sacks of books to the books editor and bags of frocks to the fashion editor. Twitters of pleasure, like spring birdsong, greeted every new delivery to fashion. In books, each fresh sack would generate sighs and groans. And once, in the case of a distressed temp who was finally escorted from the building, the rending of garments. The turbine hum of great minds at work on momentous matters was almost audible as you stepped out of the lift onto the fourth floor, where the windows gave onto views of a multi-story car park whose interlinking ramps and walkways resembled an etching by Cornelius Escher. On this floor, men and women in their serious middle years, their days of Mardi Gras long behind them, were said to live by the broadsheet journalist's law of gravitas. Every article in the opinion pages attacks every other article therein with a force that is directly proportional to the product of their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. Only those who fully understood this law and could write its algebraic formula from memory, it was claimed, were permitted to work on the opinion pages. Above opinion, obits, politics and crossword, and high above the traffic, the flats, the shriveled trees in the multi-story car park on the fifth floor, the view was of untrammeled skies and cloudscapes. Here, the elegant Lyra Moore presided over the Sunday team, screened from her staff by constantly replenished urns of flowers, discreetly soliciting the finest prose from the world's most renowned writers, and matching it with photographs of such beauty and economy that they demanded to be scissored from the magazine's pages, framed in limed oak, and mounted on the wall of a Docklands loft. Here, too, behind a portcullis of polished chrome, through a double door of reinforced glass, beyond the searchlight glare of his secretary Hazel, sat the Monitor's editor-in-chief, Austin Wedderburn, when he was in residence. Hazel controlled Wedderburn's diary and could delineate his daily trajectory through London and the home counties minute by minute more efficiently than any military satellite tracking system. This was no mean task, since Wedderburn was a man for whom the vexations of office life were an inconvenient interruption in an abundant social calendar. The Monitor was read, as it had always been read, by captains of industry and politicians, cultural grandees, senior figures in the judiciary, archbishops, and the rackety remnants of the English aristocracy. In short, the people of influence whom Wedderburn liked to meet at dinner parties. That the paper was now also read by hairdressers and shop assistants, taxi drivers and policemen, cleaners and canteen workers, was a source of quiet satisfaction to circulation and marketing, but it was unwise to remind Wedderburn of the fact.
Okay, thank you both very much. We're just going to talk for 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to ask Annalena and Tom some questions, and then we'll throw it open to the floor and take questions for the last 10 or so minutes. So I just wanted to begin by both your novels. Resonated a lot with me as I'm a journalist, and it's always nice to read about your own life or an approximation of it in a novel. But at the same time, I have a perception, I think, that novels about the media generally and newspapers perhaps in particularly are sort of not very fashionable in a way. And I've heard sort of editors say, things like, bloody media satires, that's what everyone wants to write, as if this was, a terrible thing. And perhaps a novelist should, be writing about things very different from, I suppose, the lives of middle-class people who tend to, work in newspapers and publishing and so forth. That's my perception anyway. So I just wondered if either of you had any views on that, perhaps starting with Tom.
Sure, yeah. Can I get a bit of water first?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. Thanks. I think that I certainly have encountered that same sort of response in that I've been told by, I've met editors who have said, we generally never publish books about newspapers because we just get so many. I think that part of the problem is that so many people who work in journalism would love to write a novel, and when they come around to it, then the plain subject is going to be the one that they know well. And therefore, there's a risk that many of these novels are going to be semi-autobiographical attempts to settle scores, which is incredibly satisfying for the writer and terribly unsatisfying for everybody else. So I think that's part of the reason. I mean, I'm always struck, actually, given how many novelists had experience in journalism, I'm struck by how few classic journalism novels there are. We were alluding to this a little bit before, but I think of the greatest ones like Scoop, and then Towards the End of the Morning, and New Grub Street you mentioned, but really, for decades and decades, there's not a tremendous amount of material. I think that it could be the very risk that I'm talking about, that these books tend to be of a certain sort. When they're not that sort, there's one other sort that they tend to be, which is by people who know nothing about journalism but find a journalist a very handy plot tool to uncover facts. So just use like a detective.
Yeah,
And then they tend to be...
The reporter sort of doing their business.
And then it'll be either the reporter as the heroic crusader or the reporter as sleazeball and cliché. Which is only partly true.
Yeah, no, that's. I think that's very true. I mean, I suppose. Also, I suppose the examples like Scoop and, as you say, Towards the End of the Morning, which I suppose have set the bar intimidatingly high in a way, which maybe deters some people from following down that path. But Annalena, I wanted to ask you. Just thinking about this sort of. Discussion and reading both your novels. I mean, it struck me that newspapers are an unusually good subject for a novel because of the way, they're a microcosm in themselves, all these sort of rivalries. A lot of what happens in a newspaper is pretty, when you look at it objectively from the outside, is pretty ridiculous. And the way that newspapers are kind of, what they do is plugged into all these other areas of society, so you can kind of create a sort of novel that feels relevant and so forth. Is that what you think, or is it, or would other subjects have been just as potentially interesting to you, but, it's more that it's what you knew from your own career?
It certainly is what I knew, but I think journalism, journalists are, among our many vices, rather narcissistic, and we love to read about ourselves, but the good thing about it is that the general public seem to be to have an appetite for it too. And in America, there was the late 19th century, Harding Davis started these stories, Gallagher the Copy Boy, which were very romantic stories about the newsroom, which were incredible bestsellers, not among journalists exclusively. And in fact, as late as the 1960s, Disney was making little movies based on this romantic story of a young lad on a local newspaper in America. So, and I think in life as well as in fiction, journalism does hold some interest for the general reader, as I think evidenced by the interest in the phone hacking scandal.
Of course,
I mean, all human life is there. And I would hope that the best novels about journalism are not simply of interest to people who make a living filing copy, you know, any more than Moby Dick is only of interest to people who make their living seafaring.
That's interesting. One thing that struck me is that most novels, and this is true of both your novels, both most novels about newspapers that I can think of are comedies, or at least involve, you know, large comedic elements to them, which was something I just wanted to ask you about. I mean, is it that basically because newspapers are, you know, as I said, rather slightly absurd places in many ways, or that they're full of very, you know, frustrated, embittered people, and that's a sort of natural kind of character for a comedy. Tom, what would you say about that?
I think probably there's something to that. I think that there's a long shadow of Scoop really being such a genius novel, and one that is simply a lampoon of that business and makes it difficult to subsequently write about it seriously. But I think also there are certain absurdities about people who work in journalism. I think that there's often a degree of vanity in them, that there's a sense that they too are important people because they have proximity to important people. And in some cases they can also be terribly aggressive and ambitious people, and there, I think, are certain hypocrisies and frustrations that probably, again, you know, the people who are writing these novels are going to be ex-reporters who get to exercise their frustrations on the page, and maybe that's why they tend to be lampooned that way.
I mean, and one thing also, both your novels involve sort of characters who I mean, the character you read, the Bits guy, who then if it's not giving too much away, who then sort of affects a sort of perch on the culture editor and becomes a culture editor very quickly. And Alina, your main character Tamara Sim, who's this rather sort of industrious, but also rather sort of in many ways hopeless journalist who gets kind of everything wrong and sort of, you know, doesn't know any long words and sort of just puts them randomly into articles and so forth. You know, by the end she actually sort of gets her, you know, long desired promotion and so forth. And it struck me that newspapers are places, they have this rather, you know, sort of very, I suppose, very sort of fluid structure. You know, things can change overnight for someone. You write a sort of good article and suddenly you're kind of, you know, the editor loves you and you suddenly sort of ascend very fast, or equally you stagnate for ages and so forth. I mean, which maybe is a rather good, you know, it's that sort of very fluidity is perhaps rather good for kind of for plot, because a lot can happen quite fast. I mean, I wondered if that was, and obviously in Tom, in your book, you know, each chapter deals with a different figure at this newspaper. And, you know, the very fact that it's a newspaper allows quite a lot to happen in a short amount of time.
Yeah, I think also the fact that the journalists are often dealing with issues of real import, that also is relevant, because even if the shenanigans within the newsroom itself lack in drama, then surely the events that they're covering will have them. But I think that one other reason why perhaps there's a tendency toward comedy in these stories is because And perhaps why there aren't that many really successful journalistic books is because I don't feel that there are many that really capture what it's like. I think that unfortunately they tend to go to the extremes, that they tend to be absurd parodies, or as I said, you know, they lionize these characters. And I think that's why, surprisingly, after years and years of journalists writing novels, there's a place for a book like The Spoiler, and hopefully for mine too, that I think try to, with some humor, characterize, you know, what this environment really is like at a point in history when it's heading towards extinction.
Well, and I think, since you referenced my book, it's my turn to reference yours. The thing about Tom's book as well is that it's about journalism, sure, but it's also about parenting, it's about grief, it's about affairs, and, you know, everyone's life outside the newsroom is brought to life. They're not cardboard characters going around with green eye shades and notebooks. So
and of course, in your novel, Tamara is, you know, although in some ways she's a bit of a sort of, in the way she operates at work, she's sort of out of her depth and shallow. You know, she actually has a rather rich story because her brother is a drug addict. And, so when she goes home, she becomes a completely different character. So I suppose journalists sort of, you know, have these dual lives. And then, you know, I was going to ask you one thing, which is, I mean, your novel is sort of, you know, it's poised on the sort of, at the dawn of the internet age, when obviously things are changing, and you know, you worked at newspapers for a long time, and I sort of, you know, in some ways there's an element of sort of, you know, this is a kind of, I know, of nostalgia perhaps, for not nostalgia but sort of commemoration of a particular way of doing things, I sensed, and it's in a sort of transition, and there's a sort of, you know, old way and the new way, but I also felt. And I felt and much enjoyed a rather sort of dark or kind of rather cynical view of newspapers, which emerged from your book, I think. You have a scene at the Daily Conference where you sort of portray the section heads all sort of seeking to undermine each other, and in a rather sort of, you know, and a lot of what the characters get up to is really quite it's really quite sort of barbaric behaviour in many ways. There's this sort of scene at the press awards where, you know, everyone gets drunk and starts sort of throwing punches at each other and stuff. I mean, I enjoyed it very much, but I was left with the impression that you're kind of, you know, well, are you pleased to have left newspapers behind you?
I love newspapers and have great affection and for the form and for people within it. But actually, that press awards punch up that I described is based on press awards, which I think it was the Sunday People had a fist fight with the sports desk of another tabloid. These things happen. Actually, the wrongdoing, venality in my book is overshadowed by what's emerged with the phone hacking of what's been going on since with phone hacking of murder victims, and you know, really there's a lot of bad behavior. But of course we know that most people in newspapers, and certainly our newspapers, decent and moral people and don't cross the line in that way, but there is still some extraordinary bad behavior has gone on. And I would say it wasn't parody. It was rather mild.
Well, no, absolutely. It kind of, you know, it's been, as you say, events have proved you more than right. Just going to ask about sort of technology, as it's, you know, it's a theme of both of your books, in a way, the way the industry is changing. And, you know, every journalist knows that the internet has completely, you know, completely transformed the way we do things. You know, print is now no longer sort of seen as, you know, even at The Guardian, where you used to work, Anne, you know, print is becoming the sort of, you know, poor cousin of the internet and the website, which is something you show rather presciently in your novel. Is the attraction of writing a newspaper novel like this? It's partly that you're sort of showing a world that is vanishing and that, you know, that may not be around in 10 years. Just wonder if
Tom, I think definitely. I mean, I felt that when I began to write this book, I didn't actually conceive it as being set at a newspaper at all, which is strange given that it's so now interlaced with everything in the book. But really, I came up with characters and I came up with storylines, and it was only when I saw some sort of common setting that I picked one that I knew I could describe with some authenticity. But also I chose it because I thought that it was a remarkable moment in cultural history, and a moment that I had seen, you know, in the approximately say 10 years that I had studied and then worked in journalism, I had seen extraordinary changes. And I remember that when I was studying the journalism in New York, I think it was the first year at the Columbia Journalism School where they had a course on new media, and you know, 10 years or 10 plus years later, then that is all the courses that they would have. I mean, there are others too, but everything would be focused around that now. And this is just a decade during which many of the people who taught me had, you know, been there in the old days, talked about teletype and things that I don't even understand. And you know, there were morning papers and afternoon papers, and in just a matter of years, it was such a profound transformation, and one that anybody who's working in the business knows changed also the way that people in the business worked and the content, and it's probably clear to readers as well. But it's been such a dramatic and profound change, and one that has happened at such a pace that whatever else had been written about newspapers in the past, I felt like this was a moment to capture.
Yeah, I mean, Annalena, in your novel, I mean, it's there was quite amusing period references. You know, the internet's sort of just begun, and it's seen as a rather inefficient way of sort of communicating in the office because kind of no one really reads, or only a few people read them, or so forth. And you know, there's a reference to mobile phones being, you know, too expensive to afford, so you have to have one on expense account, which obviously now seems completely sort of, you know, and it's only sort of 14 years ago. It seems completely sort of a different world in a way. And I just wondered, I mean, what's your view of sort of, you know, the digital journalism now that seems to be the way direction it's going? I mean, are you sort of pleased that you don't have to, you know, do that in a way? Or would you relish it if you were there?
I'm not a Luddite.
Yeah.
And I love the internet, and I downloaded my Guardian Observer today on my Kindle on my way here. So I'm happy and at ease with it, but they haven't really worked out a way of making any money with it, and journalists are having to work extra hard and blog and tweet. Mm. And I wonder whether there is a danger of kind of dilution of skills. But, you know...
Well, I mean, exactly, you're sort of, you know... I know because I sort of work with her, your successor as editor of the Guardian Review, you know, now has to sort of tweet and blog all the time. And, you know, in your novel, the sort of upmarket supplement Sunday, which I suppose has some sort of, you know... reminded me in some ways of the Guardian Review. You know, it's impossible to imagine the editor of that sort of indulging in such sort of activity. So I just wondered if, you know, if you were there, still there, would you happily blog and tweet?
No, I wouldn't. Actually, I have to say, it's not my temperament. I like to think long and hard before I say anything, let alone write anything.
Yeah.
So I do worry that there is, or I don't worry, but I there is a concern that there is so much out there that the quality is low. And I'm very interested to read somebody like Jaron Lanier, who was a pioneer of the web, who's now saying, you know, there's no accountability, there's a digital Maoism in the way that readers are, in a spurious way, I think, invited to feel that they are part of the process. And in fact, you know, civilized people like people here will not be sending abusive emails to newspapers or threads at the end of stories. But there's an awful lot of cloacal stuff out there. I think that's got to be watched.
Mm. Yeah, Tom, I just... wanted to ask you, I mean, about your own experience in sort of in journalism and how that sort of informed the book. I mean, it's obviously quite striking that your book's set in Rome in an English. I mean, it's I suppose it's not not the sort of most obvious journalistic setting for, you know, for a novel about one, you know, one would assume one would choose a sort of, you know, a paper in London. I mean, for no particular reason, but just that, I suppose that's what most predecessors have written.
Yeah, I mean, kind of part of the reason that I said it there was because I was interested as well at, in depicting the life of expatriates and also the this curious cocoon that I had witnessed and to an extent experienced when I had worked abroad, that among journalistic circles overseas, that you have these strange newsrooms in which they will be completely American or completely British, and you step out the door and it's Nairobi, and you step back and you have all of the right biscuits and the cups of tea and everything, and so that was something I had seen and had always fascinated me. So I wanted to depict that too. But I think just one comment, if I may, on the issue of technology and all that Annalena was talking about. It seems to me that I think part of the problem right now is that newspapers, because of the fact they haven't figured out a way to manage financially in this environment, there's just been a kind of widespread panic among publishers and among the people who make these decisions. They have no idea what to do. They're losing money, whatever they do. So part of it is they just think, well, technology, we've heard that's what's happening, so let's have more of it. And they will tell reporters to start tweeting, to start blogging, to do video and take photos and so forth. Now, obviously, then you have, as you said, put it very well, the dilution. And I think that in the end, probably what we will have is that there will be almost two tiers, or two sorts of journalism, that there'll be that which is the immediate update about so-and-so said this with no particular context to it, but just a fact that you happen to get immediately. And then there'll be another sort of journalism which attempts to explain and explicate what is actually happening in the world. I think that it's the latter that is probably what clever publishers will be exploiting and continuing to use. Publications that are doing well, things like The Economist and The New Yorker and The New York Times, and those are the ones who have continued with that model. I mean, they're not doing wonderfully, but they're managing a bit better. Mm. And the ones who have just tried to jump on the immediacy bandwagon, what happens is that they end up cheapening their own product so much that they aren't really distinct from some guy standing at the corner saying, I just saw a brick go through a window.
Mm, yeah. Well, and newspapers have they're kind of caught in a bind in a way because the news is exactly what, you know, in a way the internet does much better than sort of a reporter sitting in a newsroom. If someone's out there and sees something, then they write about it. They've scooped the story. So, I mean, you know, so as you say, it's the titles which sort of offer something a bit more sort of nuanced or refined and thought about that seem to be, it is striking that the Economist makes, you know, an enormous profit these days.
Yeah.
And the FT, I think, does pretty well, and it's succeeded to get people to actually pay for online content, whereas the broadsheets are really struggling with, you know, this whole question.
And I think it's partly because of, you can see that the trajectory of their content over the past years, I mean, adding more and more junk that in the end is the exact stuff that you don't need a newspaper for, because if you're interested in that, then you can immediately get the update on some absurd website. So they've really sabotaged themselves.
Good. Well, I think it's now it's now 7 o'clock, so I think we can take some questions. So it's quite hard to see the audience because of the lighting here. So if you raise your hand very clearly, that will help a lot. Okay, a question at the front here.
Yes, I have a question for both Annalena and Tom.
From the portions of your books that you read, I would say that none of your characters came across as overly sympathetic. What do you think about the characters in your books?
Yes. I think I have two characters, main characters. I didn't describe them in the piece that I read, but one, you know, the old school foreign correspondent, and the other, the young celebrity journalist. But I didn't want to make the old school. I think, like all of us, we're all a mixture of venality and virtue. So I like to think that I gave both my characters a bit of badness and a bit of goodness too. So I'm not hostile to them, actually.
On the contrary, I'm extremely fond of my characters, and I think that that the only way that I'm able to write a character is if I feel a great deal of sympathy for them. And I may not start out with it, but I think the process of trying to understand them and trying to reckon with their circumstances and their conflicts over time makes me feel a tremendous concern for them. And if I don't feel that, then the page will fall flat. And I have to somehow share in the sort of emotional tenor that they would be feeling in that scene for it to come off. And the funny thing that has occurred to me, though, often in the course of, or let's say having completed the book, was that many of these characters were people who, had I met them in real life, I would have run in the opposite direction, and yet writing about them, I feel very fond of them.
Any more questions? Just up there on the right.
Yeah, I just wondered, was it important for you to have left journalism to write the books, and why did you leave journalism?
Yeah, it was very important to have left journalism to have written the book, mainly as a matter of time. I mean, when I wrote this book, actually, I had an arrangement with the International Herald Tribune where I would work for half of a year full time, and then I would leave for half a year and write. I had previously tried to write fiction when I was working full time, and it was beyond me. I just couldn't possibly do it. I don't know how people can. Some do. So I absolutely had to leave it. The reason that I left it was because I had always wanted to write fiction, and I turned 30 and realized that I was looking a great deal more like a journalist than like a novelist, and so I had better make a decision. It was to leave my job and try and juggle something from thereafter.
Same, really, although it took me a bit longer than 30 to achieve the freedom. But, I left, really, my last job in journalism was I got the opportunity to found a section and to edit it. And for me, this was just the best job in journalism. It was fantastic. But after 6 years, I thought, what next? There's going to be nothing as good as this. Maybe I should sit down and write that book that I always wanted to write.
Can I just ask quickly, did you write at all fiction before you embarked on this? I mean, had you been scribbling away?
Well, actually,
all those years,
I published eight children's books.
Yes, of course,
so,
you did that.
But they're small, and you can do a day job while you're writing children's books.
But no sort of adult children. Fiction before?
No adult fiction before.
Question at the front here.
Yes, I haven't read either of your books, though I hope to. So I just want to ask a general question, which is a question about your reflections on journalism as it now is. Two particular points. Do newspapers report news, or do they manufacture it? And the second is... what do you think about the charge that the press has become much too obtrusive, and how does privacy versus exposure work under today's circumstances? I'm sorry, they're difficult in general, but I can't ask specific questions.
No. Well, yeah.
Should we take 3 or 4 hours to answer this?
Annalena, do you want to start? Because your novel obviously deals quite a head-on way with this question of exposure. It's a fairly unpleasant plot to expose one of your characters, which the younger character masterminds.
Yes, it does look at intrusiveness into somebody's personal life. And I think it's quite a simple issue. I mean, that if you use the public interest defense, then... You know, I think the tabloid approach to prying into people's private lives is indefensible. But I feel quite uncomfortable when I see distinguished journalists rallying to the defense of the tabloids and saying that, you know, we're in danger of losing press freedom. I think it's quite simple to safeguard people's private lives and their predilections. and, you know, let journalists get on with doing what they should be doing, which is exposing wrongdoing in high places and reporting the news. And I think they do indeed report the news. There is a sense that sometimes they manufacture the news, and at the moment we're in an interesting phase where they are the news, and we're going to get a bit more of that.
So. Yeah, I worked predominantly in American publications, and one of the great paradoxes about this for me was that in the United States there's a great deal more press freedom, that there aren't the restrictive libel laws that you have here, and yet the press in America tends to be much more respectful and much more restrained, and the press here tends to go wild despite the fact that they face all sorts of penalties in court. And it's something that always puzzled me. I think that really one of the chief differences is the degree of competition that has in the newspaper market here. It's been so intense that it has become savage over the years, and it has become a sort of spiral into the lowest common denominator. Whereas the American system, which doesn't really have much time left, is one that has been supported generally by sort of almost philanthropic families who wish to have a public safeguard in a publication that will try to present information more or less accurately. Now, I'm not saying that in the United States publications are good entirely, but there is quite a dramatic difference in the way that they're used. In terms of whether news is reported or manufactured, it's a very interesting question, because I think that the reporting of it then, of course, manufactures the story. I mean, I remember in practical terms that if it so happened that it was the consensus in a newsroom that something was a big story, it would get on the front page. You'd want then a follow-up and so on, and so on. Somebody else would feel, you know, that your competitor would feel, well, okay, they think it's a big deal. We should also think it's a big deal. So these things do get built up by the press, and sometimes for fairly arbitrary, strange reasons. I think, though, that the real problem faced now on both sides of the Atlantic is that the financial models have just fallen apart. So the competition and the threats to publications are increasingly intense and acute, and I think that will force people to be desperate. I think it was easy to be the noble Washington Post or New York Times when you were making money hand over fist being that, but when you're losing it, then people start to think, what should we be doing differently? And so I think that one of the reasons that we've had a lot of these problems lately, and one of the worrying things about the future, is that the financial situation has not been resolved. So one can assume, I think, that many of the proud principles of the past will continue to be violated, and even more so.
I think we've got time for one or two more questions. Well, maybe the lady there, and then the one at the back after that.
I just wondered if it's at all possible if they would ever bring out a newspaper, a good news newspaper.
Can everyone hear?
Whether it would be possible that they'd ever bring out a good news newspaper, because there must be so much out there.
Would anyone want to read it?
I think the cultural sections of newspapers generally fulfil that role of lifting the heart or raising the game in many ways.
I like the question. I mean, it makes one think, and I think it would be very difficult to report on, because many of the happiest moments are not ones that require the police, for example. So I think that the negative events, negative characters in society, powerful ones who may affect you for ill, are the ones who get the most prominence in the public sphere, because they really do change things. That I think that the many of the happy moments and happy stories tend to be quite private ones that are difficult to root out.
Was it Henri de Montalin who said, happiness writes white, leaves no trace?
Yeah. Also, it'd be hard just to write the story, because You know, I mean, I think that even in fiction, that it's conflicts and distress that tend to stir characters into decisive moments that reveal their personalities and make for drama. But there are very, very few great novels that tell happy stories, really.
Thank you. There's one question at the back we're going to take quickly.
Should I give him, sorry.
I just wanted to point out that there is a positive news newspaper, but it's by subscription only.
Oh. Could you tell us what it is?
I think it's called Positive News.
I have something to say. There was an arts project, actually, that the Yes Men, they released the New York Times and only did positive news for a day, and they'd said that the war was over and financial crisis had ended. It was fabulous. It threw everyone off a little, of course. I thought I'd add that in. And we have two questions here.
Okay.
Just to draw on your experience, really, but also slightly putting you in a fictional place, if you were a journalist now and you had set your heart on being a journalist, where would you recommend that young, sort of talented individual go?
Well, I guess you'd have to tell them to write a blog.
They are actually doing that.
Good.
Interesting enough.
But I think local papers are still, though they may have migrated to the web, they're still actually very healthy and have high circulations, and I would encourage somebody to do that.
I think that within journalism there's such a wide range of different positions that it's too hard a question to answer. I would want to know precisely what areas the person was interested in, and then that would affect the response. If they wanted to be a foreign correspondent, then I would have particular answers to that. If it was that they wanted to write about films, it would be a different answer completely. So I think, though, that the overarching theme would just be to make sure that you pursue what you're passionate about, write what you're passionate about as much as you can, and don't get drawn into financial journalism if you can avoid it.
And the other question on the slide there.
You referred to local papers just now. They're not all doing well. A lot of them are really struggling. And I'd like your comments, please, on the fact that a lot of people don't realise that the whole democratic process is being underlined. The local papers don't cover the town hall meetings, the county council, any of the things going on behind closed doors. We have no idea what is going on. And I think that's something which hasn't been properly taken into account. I wondered if you wanted to comment.
You're right, that is a concern. But there has also been a resurgence in local papers in some areas. I mean, that applies to court coverage. That's no longer done. But you will see pockets of... there are a couple of very good community websites, Scotland, Camden Town, and they are increasingly reflecting their constituency. So there are signs of hope there. I certainly wouldn't say that all local newspapers are doing well, but I would say that people have an appetite for news. They want to know what the neighbours are doing. They want to know what's happening locally. And there's inevitably going to... local papers or local coverage will always be there. But I share your concern about... I mean, actually, I had to cover council meetings and planning subcommittees, and it's incredibly boring to do it, but it's a necessary task. Yeah.
Do we have time for one more question? I think there was another one.
Tom mentioned the possibility that what will happen because of the internet is there'll be two tiers of journalism. Ian Jack had a piece in The Guardian yesterday. It was a very, very fine elegy for the printed newspaper, but he suggested another possibility. He said printed newspapers might survive rather like artisanal cheese, that they will be sort of special editions for fanatics, rather like we download our music, but there's a cult of vinyl. Could you actually imagine working in artisanal cheese journalism?
I'd rather eat artisanal cheese than work in it, but I think that the problem with that is that newspapers typically are a disposable object. I mean, if it were a question of folio society editions of books, that's a different issue, because there's something that you want to keep, you want to have in your home. But a newspaper has never been, rarely is it an object that people wish to keep, unless it's their birthday or the moon landing or something. So I think that's hard to imagine. But I think that it's very possible that paper could continue to print news over the years, but I think if it does, it'll be increasingly marginal. It's just not viable, unfortunately.
Annalena, would you like to say?
Well, they keep talking about the holy grail of electronic paper that's foldable. You can read it in the bath, on the beach, and download your stuff. Your daily interests from your favorite newspaper website that way. But until then, I mean, maybe I'm of a dying generation. I love the Kindle, reading my newspaper on the Kindle or the iPhone. But if I'm somewhere on a tube and there's a screwed up old newspaper in a corner, or indeed in Scotland recently, my groceries were wrapped in a 5-week-old copy of the Ross-shire Journal, and I read everything about the school fate. So maybe I am a subscriber to the artisanal cheese school of journalism.
Thank you very much. Then I think Diana's just going to say a few words to round things off.
I realised this session could go on, but I did very much want to thank the speakers and draw it to a close at a point where you still got an opportunity to come and talk to them when they're at the bookstall signing their books with a drink. I did also very quickly want to say something about the form of both these books. Tom's book has been referred to as a novel, but in other it is also, one could also refer to it as a series of linked stories. It has a very very exceptional form. Annalena's is a strikingly successful debut novel. I think both those books are very likely to become classics, because as we've heard and as you said, they've captured a moment in time, and if you look back on at the canon, they're very frequently books of that nature. So thank you, Annalena, thank you, Tom, and thank you so much, Will, for conducting the conversation. So I'm going to thank them and then ask you all to remain seated while we take them to out of the auditorium and to the bookstore. Thank you all very much.